The God of the Bible is a God of politics. There's no way getting around that. Some people want to. It's really the inevitable consequence of his sovereignty over history. Daniel once said to the great emperor Nebuchadnezzar, "The Most High rules over the kingdoms of men and gives them to whoever he chooses." Now, a claim like that embarrasses some people. They want to limit the kingdom of God to the boundaries of the church, or to confine it to some future millennial age. They want to argue that it's the devil, not God, who's in charge of political affairs in our present day, and that the Christian should therefore have nothing to do with politics. But that really just doesn't square with what the Bible says. Daniel's assertion in the Old Testament about the universal exercise of God's sovereign reign in the political sphere is re-echoed by Paul in the New Testament. He says there is no power except of God, and the authorities that exist have been established by God. Indeed, Jesus himself endorses exactly the same theology of politics, if you want to call it that, when he was standing before Pilate, and he said, "You could have no power at all over me except it were given you from above." This, of course, is why the prophets so courageously called kings to account. Not just kings of Israel, kings of all countries. If we find Nathan rebuking David, then we find Daniel rebuking Nebuchadnezzar. If we find Elijah sent on a mission to Ahab, then we find Jonah sent on a mission to the king of Assyria. If Ezekiel has a ministry to the exiles of Judah, he also has a very large section in his prophecy relevant to the king of Tyre. And as for Jeremiah, perhaps the greatest prophet of the Old Testament, the last chapters of his prophecy contain oracles regarding just about every Middle Eastern nation of the ancient world. All because, you see, the prophets were convinced that Jehovah was the king. The princes of the earth might conspire together against him, but it was all in vain. He sat in heaven and laughed at them. For they're all accountable to him. Wherever, whenever they reign, they are accountable to him under his sovereign authority. So there's nothing essentially demonic about politics. Nothing more demonic about it than any other area of human activity. Kings, politicians, they're men. They can be evil, they can be good. The only difference is that whereas other men's sins usually affect only themselves and their immediate neighbours, the moral failures of politicians ruin whole societies. And that, no doubt, is why God is particularly concerned that politicians should do their jobs well. And if we haven't come to that conclusion from our study of the rest of the Bible, then the book of Proverbs would certainly confirm it to us. You see, for one thing, the book of Proverbs is written almost totally by kings. Have you thought about that? Solomon, of course, preeminently, as chapter 1, verse 1 says. But according to 25, verse 1, King Hezekiah played a role too. More than that, though, Proverbs is not only written by kings. In a very considerable degree, the book of Proverbs was written for kings. Because if you read it, you'll find that again and again, Solomon addresses his son as he's writing these proverbs, or compiling them. Presumably he has the royal prince Rehoboam in mind, I don't know. Certainly it is some royal successor. And again and again, in line with that, we encounter advice in the book of Proverbs which is specifically related to the exercise of government. Indeed, if you turn to the very end of Proverbs, to chapter 31, we've got there preserved a little exhortation written by the queen mother to her son, King Lemuel, who wasn't a king of Israel at all. She outlines the high moral standards that the monarchy demands of a man in the first 9 verses of that chapter 31. So you see, for a man with political ambition, he could do a lot worse than study the book of Proverbs. There's a lot in it for him. In a sense, it's a book quite literally written for him. And since these days the media seem determined to thrust politics ever more forcibly into all our lives, I guess All of us can gain something from studying tonight what Proverbs has to say on this controversial area of practical living, politics. How do you succeed in politics? Proverbs is all about being successful in life. Politics is part of that. I think we can begin with some texts in Proverbs that we could call advice on practical government. Practical politics, if you like. The sort of thing I have in mind is chapter 14, verse 28, where we read, "A large population is a king's glory, but without subjects, a prince is ruined." In other words, no ruler can do without the support of his people. That's common sense, perhaps, particularly in days like ours, when democracy makes it impossible to wield power for long without a popular consensus. But of course, in the ancient Middle East, tyranny was the norm. The sort of constitutional monarchy that existed in Israel, at least in the early days of the monarchy, must have seemed laughable to the heathen monarchs round about Israel. Certainly Jezebel never came to terms with it, did she? You remember the story of Ahab and his wife? How in the incident of Naboth's vineyard, she came to Ahab, who was feeling all sorry for himself, because the law didn't allow him to nationalize the property of Naboth that he would rather like to have owned. And Jezebel says to him, "Who's king in Israel? Who's boss around here?" See, she was the princess of Sidon, a pagan country. She had no idea about these constitutional monarchies. In her country, what her father the king wanted, he got. But then you see, Phoenician monarchy and Israelite monarchy were two quite different things. Strictly speaking, according to the law of Moses, the king of Israel had no real personal power at all. It's worth studying, if you have time, Deuteronomy 17 in this regard. You'll find there that Moses didn't allow the king any royal cavalry. He didn't allow him any royal harem. He didn't allow him any royal treasury. He didn't even allow the king to pass laws. All he allowed him to do was to enforce the laws of Moses. And Moses says explicitly in that chapter, the king is not to consider himself as better than his brothers. Well, I mean, compared to the sort of godlike reverence paid to pagan kings, that must have seemed quite extraordinary. I suppose the point of Moses' legislation on the monarchy was to ensure that a king could only exercise power if the people were behind him. He was a leader, not a dictator. No doubt the people of Israel had seen quite enough of totalitarian government in Egypt to convince them that there was wisdom in limiting the power of the sovereign. And there are several texts in Proverbs that follow that line of thought. Like 28, verse 15, for instance. "Like a roaring lion or a charging bear is a wicked man ruling over a helpless people." Perhaps they have reminiscences of Pharaoh there. I can never read it without thinking of General Amin and the ruin he brought to Uganda. Mindless, destructive, and terribly dangerous. That's how Proverbs estimates the tyrant, a roaring lion, a charging bear. His style of government may enrich him temporarily, but according to Proverbs, it won't last long. The next verse makes that plain. Verse 16 of 28. "A tyrannical ruler lacks judgment, but he who hates ill-gotten gain will enjoy a long life." The implication, of course, being that the exploitative ruler will enjoy a very short life. No doubt because he's so unpopular. 28:12 says, "When the righteous triumph, there's great elation. But when the wicked rise to power, men go into hiding." No doubt the conspirators who overthrow the tyrant are promised some joy in the city as a result of their triumph over the wicked in that verse. Perhaps it's significant that this particular chapter, chapter 28, which has a number of references to tyrants, falls into that cluster of proverbs in the book which were compiled by King Hezekiah. Because I suppose it was in this matter of autocratic government that Solomon's wisdom perhaps failed him a little bit. Certainly his son Rehoboam would have done well to take note of chapter 28 if he had it available, for it was his clumsy attempt to impose a despotic regime on Israel that led to the secession of the 10 northern tribes from the dynasty of David. If you know your Old Testament history, you'll no doubt remember that. Indeed, there are many ways, I think, in which it's ironic that a book purportedly intended by Solomon for his son should have been so signally ignored by his son. It was Edmund Burke who said, a nation isn't governed that has to be perpetually conquered. Force isn't a recipe for long-term stability in a nation. Proverbs would have taught Rehoboam that, if he'd read it. Monarchs, no less than democrats, need to be popular to succeed. You can't do without the support of the people indefinitely. Proverbs, however, isn't so foolish as to idolize popularity. Realizes that the value of praise depends an awful lot on the person who gives it. Like in 27 verse 21. The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but man is tested by the praise he receives. I think it's said, isn't it, that the statesman thinks about the next generation, the politician about the next election. For man's only concerned about the acclaim of the crowd and keeping his power base secure, and he's not going to be a great ruler. He's not going to be a statesman. Remember, Jesus said, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Man is tested by the praise he receives. Indeed, Solomon recognizes there is a price which is too much to pay for political influence. Like in 16, verse 19. Better, he says, to be lowly in spirit and among the oppressed than to share plunder with the proud. In other words, there are times when it's more noble to be part of an oppressed minority than identified with the lofty powers that be who are exploiting the people. Solomon knew too, no doubt from personal experience, there were plenty of people willing to butter up a king. But real loyalty was a much rarer commodity. Like in 19, verse 6. Many curry favor with a ruler, he says. But at the end of chapter 18, verse 24, there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. It would be wrong, too, to think that Proverbs encourages the politician to seek popularity at the expense of national discipline. No ruler can survive without the ability to maintain law and order. That sometimes requires a firm and perhaps a little unpopular hand. But there's plenty in Proverbs about the importance of that. Like in 28, verse 2. When a country is rebellious, it has many rulers. But a man of understanding and knowledge maintains order, it says. No doubt Hezekiah, who compiled this proverb, had had plenty of opportunity to witness the truth of those words in the history of the northern kingdom of Israel. Because that, if you read it in the book of Kings, is a sorry tale of assassinations and coups and counter-coups. Once it seems they had rejected the house of David, Israel never succeeded in finding a dynasty that would last more than a couple of generations to replace it. Proverb is true, you see. Once revolution is in the air, it tends to go on reproducing itself till at last perhaps a Napoleon or a Lenin arises who has the genius and perhaps the ruthlessness to establish order once again. When a country is rebellious, it has many rulers, but a man of understanding and knowledge maintains order. Now, it's important to be able to maintain the law. 17:11 says, an evil man bent only on rebellion will find a merciless official sent against him. It's perhaps because of the escalation in cruelty that accompanies revolution and rebellion and the need for an increasingly authoritarian hand to keep it down. The Proverbs emphasizes again and again the importance of respect for civil government, that revolution must always be a very, very last resort. Like in 24, verse 21 and 22. Fear the Lord and the king, my son, and do not join with the rebellious. For those two, that is the Lord and the king, will send sudden destruction upon them, and who knows what calamities they can bring. Notice the link there between civil authority and God's authority that we started off by talking about, and the essential unity of the wrath that they inflict on the rebellious. It's Paul would later tell us in Romans 13, the power of the sword is a divine mandate. And a nation which understands that is going to be much more politically stable. A nation which doesn't only fear the king, but fears the Lord and sees the relationship between those two authority structures is going to be a much more stable country. The only country that I can think of which has had what you might call a successful revolution, that is a revolution which hasn't ended in perpetual revolution and a continuous change of coup and counter-coup, is the United States. They successfully had a revolution and stopped there. One was enough. There aren't many countries with a record like that if you study world history. And I think there can be no doubt that one of the reasons for that was the strong influence of Puritan thinking at that time, or in the history of the people who were there. Even though some of those men were not particularly Christian men, there was a strong Christian framework of thinking that controlled their attitude towards revolution. There's a link then between biblical religion and civil order, and Proverbs makes that very plain in 29 verse 18. Where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. But blessed is he who keeps the law. Isn't that an interesting verse? Where there's no revelation, where there is no Bible, that's where you're likely to find revolution. People cast off restraint. Why? Because you don't fear the king much unless you also fear the Lord. Blessed is the man who keeps the law. Humanists have still not succeeded, you see, in formulating a morality that has got cogency, that's got authority for non-intellectuals. If the standards of right and wrong aren't preserved in a society by the mouth of God, then ultimately the people will not keep them. I guess the king of Israel must often have been infuriated by the prophets sticking their noses into political affairs. But the truth is, the prophets, by their rigid insistence on the authority of God and of his moral law, did far more than the king's troops to prevent Israel from sliding into anarchy. That's a thought that's worth considering in our generation. Of course, if a king is going to achieve this subtle blend of popularity and yet maintain discipline in the nation, he's obviously going to need a great gift of diplomacy. And that's a third thing in, under the heading, if you like, of practical politics that Proverbs has got a lot to say about. The need for diplomacy begins, according to Solomon, on your way up, when you're making your political career, and it's just beginning. Like in chapter 23, verse 1 to 3, I rather like this. When you sit to dine with a ruler, note well what, or probably better, who is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you're given to gluttony. Do not crave his delicacies, for that food is deceptive. In other words, don't forget your manners at the meal table, and be cautious about pushing yourself forward to get noticed at the banquet. Same thoughts given in 25, verses 6 to 7. Do not exalt yourself in the king's presence, and do not claim a place among great men. It's better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before a nobleman. Social climbing conducted in a brazen way rarely gains men's respect in the long term. And that superior whose attention you're so keen to gain is just as likely to snub you as to elevate you, says Proverbs. It's far wiser to keep a low profile, as they say. After all, you've only got to irritate the big man once and you've lost your chance. Chapter 20, verse 2. A king's wrath is like the roar of a lion. He who angers him forfeits his life. In any case, there are better ways, safer ways, to make a good impression, if you know a bit of diplomacy. 22:11, for instance, encourages a guileless and polite attitude. He who loves a pure heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king for his friend. Integrity is an important and rare commodity in the corridors of power, and that's going to be precious too, if you want to make a good impression. 16 verse 13. Kings take pleasure in honest lips. They value a man who speaks the truth. You see, the sycophantic yes man rarely gets promoted to the top Even the most intolerant of bosses gets fed up with people who only say what they know they want them to hear all the time. Tact is very important too. Chapter 16, verse 14 has a text about that. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man will appease it. In other words, you're not going to succeed in politics if you can't cool your boss down when he gets a bit irate. And opportunism, there's a certain place for that in verse 15 of the same chapter. When a king's face brightens, it means life. His favour is like a rain cloud in spring. In other words, you've got to be quick to spot when the old boy's in a good mood and take advantage of it. But diplomacy isn't only a key quality in the man who's on the way up. It's even more important for the man who's arrived in some position of power, according to Proverbs. Because if tactlessness and indiscretion of the man on the way up can spell the end of his career, then indiscretion on the part of a king can spell the end of peace. Look at 16 verse 32 for that one. Better a patient man than a warrior. A man who controls his temper than one who takes a city. I think that's a very, very profound little proverb. In days like ours, when people tend to turn to violence so very quickly, it's important, isn't it, to hear the word of God counseling restraint. The Bible isn't pacifist. God sometimes commanded men to take up arms in the Bible. But violence is never reveled in. It's very much a last resort. The possibility of negotiation has always got to be exhausted first. Diplomatic channels, says Proverbs, often achieve far more than you think they will, so long as you give them time. Patience is such an important quality for the diplomat. Like in 25, verse 15. Through patience, a ruler can be persuaded. A gentle tongue can break a bone. That'd be a good text for Margaret Thatcher in her conferences with Giscard d'Estaing, wouldn't it? Through patience, a ruler can be persuaded. I hope she believes that. Even in a situation of civil strife, sending in the riot squad with tear gas and rubber bullets may not be the shrewdest move. Chapter 29, verse 8. Mockers stir up a city, but wise men turn away anger or calm things down. It's too easy, you see, to escalate, and violence is always an escalatory response. Of course, there are times when war is inevitable. And Proverbs recognizes that. When that happens, a successful politician needs not so much diplomacy as military strategy. That's another quality he's got to have in his armory of virtue. 21 verse 22. Wise men attack the cities of the mighty and pull down the strongholds in which they trust. Of course, strategic studies, the wisdom to wage war, which that verse is talking about, is a very specialist field. Peacetime politicians are not always good generals, are they? Those of you who fought in the last war will no doubt agree with that. And so it's at the time of war that a politician must be willing to take advice, perhaps more than any other time. Proverbs certainly stresses that. 24 verse 6. For waging war, you need guidance. And for victory, you need many advisers. Again in 2018. Make plans by seeking advice. If you wage war, obtain guidance. It's very important. There are several texts to this effect. But Solomon knows too that the best advice in the world can't guarantee victory. There's a very important text at the very end of chapter 21 in this regard. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests with the Lord. I find that greatly comforting. See, it's not superior strategy or technology that really wins a war. It's the Lord's providence. If the Lord had not been on our side, let Israel now say, if the Lord had not been on our side, they would have swallowed us alive. I guess many were reading that psalm at the time of Dunkirk. Perhaps it should put heart into us today, when sometimes we tremble to see the sort of vast engines of destruction that are arrayed against our little island, the nuclear warfare potential, not only of ourselves, but of many other countries. It's comforting perhaps to remember that naked military might will no more determine the course of the Third World War than it did the Second. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests with the Lord. And if victory is the gift of God, then, says Solomon, peace is the reward of God. In chapter 16, verse 7. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies live at peace with him. That's true on the small scale, and it's true on the international scale. We speak of the ultimate deterrent, but I doubt very much whether there is such a thing. Talk of an ultimate deterrent places altogether too much reliance on the rationality of man for my liking. Now, what really deters an enemy is the fearlessness of a people who are absolutely convinced of the power of their God. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies live at peace with him. What worries me far more than Russian tanks and missiles is the appalling collapse of moral and spiritual vigour in our culture. If the Lord takes peace from our shores yet again, it'll be much more attributable to that than any failure on our part to keep pace with the Eastern Bloc military stockade. So here are the qualities which a politician has got to have, sort of practical political virtues. Popularity, the ability to maintain law and order, diplomacy, strategy in times of war for foreign policy. But there's a quality perhaps that Proverbs puts more emphasis on than any other, and that is jurisprudence. Jurisprudence is the ability to decide legal cases wisely and justly. For of course, the monarchy of Israel saw jurisprudence, the exercise of justice, as a very, very important part of their duties. The king was a kind of ombudsman sitting in Jerusalem, which people could come to and present their troubles, their grievances, their cases. Perhaps you recall that fascinating story recorded about Solomon, how two women came, each claiming that a baby was their own, and how he settled that very difficult judgment. Well, Proverbs has got a lot of advice for those whose politics involves the exercise of justice. One thing it recommends very strongly is the importance of careful cross-examination. Chapter 18, verse 17. The first to present his case seems right, till another comes forward and questions him. See, there are always two sides to every story. And the judge has to account on that. It's important to hear both before you apportion blame or decide your verdict. Perhaps a more surprising and more controversial piece of advice for magistrates comes in the following verse, in chapter 18, verse 18. Casting the lot settles disputes and keeps strong opponents apart. Now, no doubt this seems a very hazardous way of determining justice to us. You know, actually, the lot was a very respected method of deciding difficult matters in ancient Israel. In fact, if you've heard of that Urim and Thummim, have you remember that strange device which was at the disposal of the high priest? It was almost certainly some kind of sacred lot by which he could determine verdicts, yes or no. It wasn't an appeal to luck, as far as the people in Israel were concerned. It was a confession of faith. Well, 16:33 says, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Perhaps our judges would be relieved of a great deal of anguish and enabled to decide with a great deal more equity if they were allowed to occasionally toss a coin on the bench. It certainly save a good many legal expenses and long legal arguments. But of course, the most important thing as far as jurisprudence goes is justice. Simple justice, fairness. And Proverbs is full of texts about this. 17, verse 26, for instance. It's not good to punish an innocent man or to flog officials for their integrity. 18, verse 5. It's not good to be partial to the wicked or to deprive the innocent of justice. Well, this is obvious to us, no doubt. But you see, it enshrines a very important tenet of the Bible's political philosophy. Namely, that the law of the king is not absolute. It's not true to say that anything the king does is by definition good. There is a standard of good which evaluates even the acts of monarchs. If they flog an official who has shown integrity because his integrity happens to have been inconvenient, it is not good, says Proverbs. If he's partial to the wicked for some political motivation, it is not good, says Proverbs. There is an arbiter, you see, of what is good that stands over the power of government. Or to put it another way, kings are not above the law. They are themselves morally accountable. This is a very important point. People often ask the difficult question of whether Christians should ever support a revolution. And I have a suspicion that these arguments are going to be rekindled regarding the South African question in the next couple of years. But what is for sure is that there is only one possible ground on which Christians could ever participate in revolution. And that is on the grounds that the powers that be have seriously departed from goodness. So seriously that they no longer reflect the authority of God in society at all, and have so forfeited their divine mandate. They no longer wield the sword of God's wrath. It was this sort of argument, of course, that Cromwell used. He argued that Charles was no longer the legitimate sovereign. And the Huguenots in Europe applied similar arguments. I suspect in the context of Southern Africa today, the same issues are going to be hotly debated. Whether or not the fact that there is a standard of goodness over governments by which their judgments and their acts can be evaluated, whether that implies the possibility of revolution or not, it certainly means that the politician is accountable, that he is under the law just as much as his subjects. And not every political philosophy has recognized that. Certainly, Proverbs is convinced that an oppressive and an unjust regime has got no right at all to expect to be either prosperous or long-lasting. Look at chapter 24, verses 23 to 25. To show partiality in judging is not good. Whoever says to the guilty, "You are innocent," peoples will curse him, and nations denounce him. But it will go well with those who convict the guilty, and rich blessing will come upon them. You see, there's going to come trouble for the unjust regime, sooner or later. On the other hand, according to 29 verse 14, if a king judges the poor with fairness, his throne will always be secure. Because one form of corruption, which is common the world over, is bribery. And Solomon has some particular comments about that. On the one hand, he recognizes the effectiveness of a little bit of palm greasing. Chapter 17, verse 8. A bribe is a charm to the one who gives it. Wherever he turns, he succeeds. He says it can open previously locked doors. 18, verse 16. A gift opens the way for the giver and ushers him into the presence of the great. Well, we've all seen that happen. It can also smooth over differences and forestall opposition. 21 verse 14. A gift given in secret soothes anger, and a bribe concealed in the cloak pacifies great wrath. But the candidness of these observations about the effectiveness of bribery ought not to it be interpreted as approval. Moses said quite clearly in the law that bribery was wrong, and no matter how effective it may sometimes seem, Solomon is firm in his moral verdict about it. 17 verse 23. It is a wicked man, he says, who accepts a bribe to pervert the course of justice. See, what bribery means in practice is that the rich get a better deal than the poor. Solomon's adamant that ultimately that kind of financial inducement is self-defeating. Because both the one who gives the bribe and the one who receives it are going to end up the poorer, not the richer. 22 verse 16. He who oppresses the poor to increase his wealth, and he who gives gifts to the rich, both come to poverty. Still, Solomon can't resist just a little characteristic dig to deflate the moral pomposity of any anti-corruption squads that may be going around. In 28 verse 21, he throws in a very thoughtful little proverb. To show partiality is not good. True enough, he says. Yet a man will do wrong for a piece of bread. The moral being, presumably, that bribery is a problem in societies where law enforcement officers aren't paid sufficient to keep them above the bread line. Maybe our anti-corruption squads would be better advised to pay the people who do the job of judging a little more. The main reason, of course, why bribery is bad is that if this sort of corruption and injustice becomes the norm in a whole nation, then the fabric of society itself starts to crumble. It's the conviction of Proverbs that social righteousness generally is a major factor in the success of any nation, and it's repeated again and again. In chapter 11, verses 10 to 11, the prosperity of the cities of the nation is tied to the uprightness of the population. Through the blessing of the upright, a city is exalted, but by the mouth of the wicked it's destroyed, they read. In chapter 29, verse 2, the contentment of the people is related to it. When the righteous thrive, people rejoice. When the wicked rule, people groan. And in chapter 28, verse 28, the insecurity of a nation which isn't ruled justly is portrayed. When the wicked rise to power, read, people fly into hiding. But I suppose the most famous of all texts along this line in Proverbs is chapter 14, verse 34, where Solomon beautifully expresses the sense of national dignity and honour, national morale, if you like, which is the result of a nation which is determined to put justice first. Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. And the key factor in the maintenance of this national righteousness, out of which so many blessings fail, is the commitment of the government to justice. 29 verse 4, by justice a king gives a country stability, but the king who is greedy for bribes tears that country down. Of course, if a king is going to succeed in administering impartial justice in this way, he's going to need many personal qualities in addition to just the ability to resist bribes. He's got to be truthful, according to 17 verse 7. And according to the Queen Mother, the mother of King Lemuel, he's got to live a sober and self-controlled life. I turn to that passage again just to see what she says. O my son, O son of my womb, she says. O son of my vows, do not spend your strength on women, your vigour on those who ruin kings. It's not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, not for rulers to crave beer, lest they drink and forget what the law decrees, and deprive all the oppressed of their rights. In other words, a good ruler has not got to be a womanizer, because women sap your strength, she says, and he's not to be a drunkard, because drink clouds your mind. And the king is going to need all his energy and all his intelligence if he's going to exercise justice for the poor correctly. Proverbs encourages shrewdness and perspicacity too in the ruler. 20 verse 8. When the king sits on his throne, his eyes winnow all evil. That's a great virtue in the king who's going to practice justice. And he's got to have compassion too. Chapter 20 verse 28. Love and faithfulness keep a king safe. Through love, his throne is made secure. Point being that a king who demonstrates his real concern for his people is unlikely to fear conspiracy. And most of all, of course, he needs wisdom. By me, kings reign, and rulers make laws who are just, says wisdom in chapter 8. I suppose when you put so many virtues and abilities and gifts together and say this is what the good politician's got to have, it all seems very idealistic. Indeed, it's notable, I think, that in the matter of the monarchy, this normally down-to-earth book, Proverbs, comes closer to idealism than almost over any other subject. Description, for instance, of the intellectual penetration of the king in chapter 25, verses 2 and 3, seems almost extravagant. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. As the heavens are high and the earth is deep, so the hearts of kings are unsearchable. seems just a little bit panegyric, doesn't it? And 1610, I think, is a little less extravagant, if not quite so obvious, because it claims that when the king speaks, he speaks with prophetic authority. The lips of the king speak as an oracle, it says. But I think most utopian of all, as far as the king goes, is chapter 21, verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a watercourse wherever he pleases. Many people take that as a statement of divine providence in political affairs. And of course that would be true if this control over the king's decisions is unconscious as far as the king is concerned. But I suspect that what Solomon is saying here is that there ought to exist between the ideal king and God a deep intimacy, so the monarch willingly administers his decisions by the Lord's direction. So there's a very idealistic picture of a king here in Proverbs. True to its characteristic cynicism, Proverbs injects a few little remarks, lest we elevate our expectation of government too high. There's an ironical little comic portrait in chapter 30 of the pomposity of kings in verses 29 to 31 of chapter 30. There are three things that are stately in their stride, he says. Four that move with stately bearing. A lion mighty among beasts who retreats before nothing. A strutting rooster, a he-goat, and a king with his army round him. I'm quite sure he had his tongue in his cheek as he wrote that. And in chapter 29, the previous chapter, verse 26, there's a telling little piece of realism for anybody who thinks that a letter to the ombudsman will solve everything. 29 verse 26, many seek an audience with a ruler, but it's from the Lord that man gets justice. Don't expect too much from the courts, says Solomon. And yet there's no doubt that this idealism is there. The perfect king doesn't exist. Solomon recognizes that, but he dreams about a perfect king in this book. He knows he himself, and certainly his sons after him, fail to live up to the high standards he lays down in this book. But it would be wrong to reject Proverbs' idea of the ideal monarch as a kind of uncharacteristic excursion into utopian dreams. For you see, Proverbs shares its dream of the perfect king with the whole of the Bible. David in his Psalms looks forward to a perfect king. The prophets in their writings predict a perfect king. And of course, we who are here tonight, what we're really here to do is to celebrate him, aren't we? Jesus shall reign where'er the sun. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice